The Hollywood Connection. In the Malaysian state funds case, Joe Low became a big player in America on both the East and West Coasts. He associated with stars like Paris Hilton and Leonardo DiCaprio, who were later unknowingly and involuntarily involved in his art dealings. And he acquired $60 million worth of real estate in New York and Los Angeles. In Manhattan, he lived in an apartment in the Park Imperial on 56th Street that cost $100,000 per month. His neighbors in the luxury building were the James Bond star Daniel Craig and the rapper Sean P. Diddy Combs, among others. In a bar in New York, the actress and singer Lindsay Lohan is said to have treated Low to 23 bottles of champagne for his 23rd birthday. According to investigations by the Wall Street Journal, Low's company, Ginwell Capital, shared in the investor buyout of EMI Music Publishing in 2011 for $2.2 billion, and 2 years later, for the same sum, participated in the acquisition of the Canadian company Coastal Energy. After he bought the Basquiat for a record price, the New York art magazine Art News, in the summer of 2013, put him on its prestigious annual list of the top 200 art collectors. But his social and cultural prestige didn't last long. As the investigations into the Malaysian state fund reached the U.S., Joe Low quickly turned from celebrated buyer to discreet seller in the same year. Starting in February 2015, works in his possession valued at $205 million changed ownership. Among them, pictures by Pablo Picasso and Claude Monet, both of which Low sold at prices that were under Sotheby's estimates. In February 2016, at Christie's, he had auctioned off the 1908 Claude Monet painting of A View of Venice, Doge's Palace, seen from San Giorgio Maggiore, for $16.7 million, less than the Low estimate. Low accepted $27.5 million instead of the estimated $40 million for Picasso's Head of a Woman. Sources have confirmed that in April 2016, a hedge fund manager, identified only as Daniel S. of Connecticut, had paid only $35 million for the once record-setting Basquiat Dustheads, which portrays two drug addicts, $13.8 million less than Low had paid for it. Voluntary losses are quite the norm in money laundering. The main thing is that the remaining money will, from then on, be clean and unsuspicious. Marlon Brando's Oscar. Selling works that allegedly belonged to him was by no means the end of the story for Joe Low. The scandal created waves and made headlines for, among others, one of the most famous Hollywood stars of the 21st century. Low had placed the money that had been entrusted to him not just in artworks, real estate, record companies, and energy concerns. He had also invested in a film project that involved the director Martin Scorsese and the actor Leonardo DiCaprio. Investors often finance Hollywood productions in the hope of respectable returns from a strong box office performance. So it didn't surprise anyone when, in 2013, the production company Red Granite put millions into three films, Dumb and Dumber 2, Daddy's Home, and, fittingly enough, The Wolf of Wall Street. Riza Aziz, the son-in-law of the Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak, was a co-founder of the U.S. company. Low allegedly had met DiCaprio earlier in connection with the work each of them did on behalf of environmental groups. As Low told the South China Morning Post, he supposedly suggested DiCaprio for the role in Scorsese's Wall Street picture, and he gave him art, the Picasso painting Still Life with the Skull of a Steer, 1939, worth $3.2 million. He sent a note with his gift to DiCaprio. "Dear Leonardo DiCaprio, happy birthday, belatedly. This gift is for you." A spokesperson for the actor confirmed later that he had accepted the gift in order to sell it at an auction for the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, LDF. And Joe Low would purchase some of his art at LDF auctions. For example, in 2015 in Saint-Tropez, he bought Roy Lichtenstein's 1982 sculpture Brushstroke for $600,000. And earlier, at the aforementioned Christie's auction, For the benefit of DiCaprio's foundation, he bought paintings by Ed Ruscha and Mark Ryden for, collectively, $1.1 million. In the spring of 2017, DiCaprio conveyed ownership of the Picasso picture to the U.S. government. He also parted with the 1982 Basquiat collage Red Man One, which he had received from Lowe. In addition, DiCaprio gave back the Oscar for Best Actor that Marlon Brando had won in 1955 for On the Waterfront. The two Red Granite owners, Riza Aziz and Joey McFarland, had given the Oscar to DiCaprio, who at that point had not won the honor himself, for his 38th birthday in November 2012. Ralph DeLuca, a dealer in memorabilia, had sold the statuette in fall 2012 for $600,000. It had disappeared from Brando's possession during his lifetime. Joe Lowe pledged a fortune worth $700 million to the government in connection with a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice at the end of October 2019. Apart from artworks by Basquiat, the Van Gogh drawing of the Yellow House in Arles, and the photo Child with a Toy Hand Grenade in Central Park by Diane Arbus, there was the Picasso painting that Lowe had given to Leonardo DiCaprio. Moreover, the Malaysian handed over Claude Monet's painting Saint-Georges Majeur, which had previously belonged to Namad. Lowe let it be known that he had not been required to make an admission of guilt. 1% for Germany. The German art market is considerably smaller than its American counterpart. According to the 2019 Art Market Report, an annual publication by the Swiss megabank UBS that is produced in early summer for the Art Basel Fair, the turnover internationally in the art market was $67.4 billion in 2018. Three countries are responsible for four-fifths of this sum: the U.S. with a 44% share, Great Britain pre-Brexit with 21%, and China with 19%. Germany can claim only 1% internationally, and within the European market, a modest 4%. Still, Germany has the most people who possess fortunes in excess of $50 million after the U.S. and China. When the Nazis robbed, deported, and murdered or exiled thousands of, mostly Jewish, art collectors, they permanently destroyed a big part of the art market in Germany. The near proximity of tax havens, which opened up plainly illegal but lucrative possibilities, is also a cause of the small size of the post-war market in Germany. Those who want to hide money from the government prefer to buy art in galleries and auction houses or from private collectors with their official residence in Zurich or Luxembourg, Monaco or Liechtenstein. The art market is booming there, but in Germany it never really recovered, in part because of the 44-year isolation of Berlin. Really valuable artworks of international stature rarely came on the market in Germany after the war. Instead, they were exported for sale. Just as German artists from Ernst Ludwig Kirchner to Martin Kippenberger are considered favorites today at auctions in New York and London, German collectors are among the chief consigners in the auction houses there. Germany placed fourth in 2018 in the rankings of the countries where the most sellers come from, behind only the U.S., Great Britain, and France. Dealers and auction houses in those countries lose out on those foreign sales and tend not to keep up with changes in taste of the global collector base and the interests of a steadily younger clientele. German art dealers, for example, have complained for years about supposed barriers to competing. They say that legal restrictions, such as the laws protecting cultural goods, the artist's resale right, according to which, since 2006, the artist or the artist's heirs are entitled to up to 4% of the proceeds of a sale, or high sales taxes, allegedly scare off the art community from buying paintings, drawings, sculptures, and prints in Germany, or from selling. Those who want to sell a Caspar David Friedrich, an Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, or a Gerhard Richter look to the international market. That many of these regulations were instituted by the German government only to encode the European standards into national law is willfully overlooked. Similarly, they disregard the fact that, for example, The German law protecting cultural goods is more generously drawn in favor of collectors and dealers than in many other EU countries, and that the cost of the bureaucracy has proved to be considerably smaller than the doomsday scenario that professional groups of German dealers had conjured up at the time the law was implemented. The law protecting cultural goods, claimed Bernd Schulz, a co-founder of the revenue-rich auction house Griesebach in Berlin, would be the guillotine for the art market. The chairman of the board of the publisher Axel Springer, Matthias Döpfner, himself a collector, labeled the draft legislation a throwback to the communist East German state. German Democratic Republic all the way. Contrary to those claims, the revenues of German auction houses didn't crater. They remained stable at the same lower level as before when compared with Great Britain and the U.S. Resistance to more oversight. The terrorist attacks in Paris in November 2015 and in Brussels in March 2016, and the question of how the responsible terrorist groups had financed themselves, led to the European Union's adopting a new directive on money laundering. The scandal surrounding the Panama Papers also propelled this development. The member governments throughout Europe were obliged to enact the directive into national law. When the German Treasury published its draft legislation to enact the change of directive for four money laundering directives in late summer 2019, the arguments put forth by art dealers resembled those they had used against the law for protection of cultural goods. With the new directive, the former scope of the law on money laundering expanded to include additional professional groups, which were also required to establish risk management and fulfill duties of due diligence and identification, and, in appropriate cases, report suspicious activity to the criminal authorities. Outside the finance sector, this change from that point on applied to art dealers, who already felt themselves under the gun. Also, art dealers and art storage businesses, these last only in duty-free zones, for transactions of 10,000 euros or more. In the future, the planned security measures apply not just to cash deals, but also to transactions by credit card, through payment systems like PayPal, or through bank accounts. According to the legislature, it is no longer quite so easy in a suspicious case to trace the flow of money because of the increasing digitalization of the payment business. In particular, the pseudonyms or anonymity employed in the trade of cryptocurrencies enables their misuse for criminal and terrorist purposes. The G20 has spoken of the necessity of regulating virtual assets in order to fight money laundering and the financing of terror. Developments in Europe also led to a new debate in the U.S. on the topic of art and money laundering. At a forum in New York in October 2018, lawyers and money laundering experts discussed the Bank Secrecy Act, which also meant stricter regulation on the art market in the U.S. At the end, they came to the conclusion that further regulatory restrictions on the art market will eventually be needed. And the numbers were almost unbelievable, partly because of the restrictions in other business sectors. Through 2026, collectors and investors worldwide will invest $2.7 trillion in art. In Germany, the backlash by the industry didn't take long. In the art magazine Monopol, the Munich attorney Gert Zeliger summarized the possible structural effects of the new law in a somewhat considered fashion. Fact: art dealers, gallerists, and auctioneers in the future not only have to identify their client, they have to conduct a risk analysis, document that analysis, and, regardless of the sales price, report suspicious cases. In practice, this will lead to substantial organizational and financial costs. The concern is not just that the buying behavior of the collector could change, but also the structure of the market, because smaller galleries and auction houses will go under. Zeliger mentioned that even at auctions where an offshore company, an anonymous numbered bidder, and proof of sufficient funds in an account formally sufficed, soon all participants will be registered at the start, since it is not foreseeable which work will sell for more than 10,000 euros. He qualified the fears about whether to expect a huge increase in bureaucratic expense. Whether the fear is justified remains to be seen. There were fears when the law for the protection of cultural goods was introduced. 100,000 export applications would be filed each year, but in the year after it was enacted, there were barely 1,000. Most art collectors won't have a problem revealing their identity as long as the art dealers use the personal information solely for the prevention of money laundering. The request for identification will not redound negatively upon the art dealers because they can always refer to the fact that they are implementing the statutory requirements. In the Kunstzeitung, a publication friendly to the art market, the lawyer Peter Rauer pulled out the heavy artillery against the proposed law. The German legislator obviously considers the German art market to be an association of money laundering specialists who must be gunned down through legislative means. The lawyer, who has regularly represented collectors, museums, and members of the art market, writes about a proposal to discriminate against an entire industry. And, in his antipathy toward the law, comes to the polemical conclusion, resale rights, social security contributions for artists, higher sales taxes for art dealers, the law for the protection of cultural goods, and now restrictions on money laundering. Can't German legislators get it into their heads that art dealing is not where terrorist financing and money laundering originate? Stop with the schizophrenic directives, and perhaps instead pay attention to the Arab clans in Berlin. They don't buy art, but rather real estate, jewelry, cars, and are therefore free from the requirements of these duties. Then the lawyer takes a misleading populist swipe at the German legislature. It is of little consolation that the 10,000 euro cutoff is expressly applied to the art market in its fifth EU money laundering directive, and the German legislator doesn't have a choice but to carry that over into law. In fact, the new German money laundering regulations also applied to real estate. The polemic on behalf of his clients unmasks itself. The coarse argument resembles in many respects that of the German art dealing associations that complained that their members were regarded with suspicion. At a meeting of the Federation of German Galleries and Art Dealers, BVDG, in May 2019, Irmgard El-Hachoumi, who leads the unit for the prevention of money laundering at the Office of Economics, Trade, and Innovation of the State Senate of the city of Hamburg, and who is one of those responsible for overseeing compliance with the new regulations, contradicted the fears of the German art dealing associations. It's not half as bad as it seems. It can actually be done. We start with the assumption that art dealers become victims of money laundering and are not the offenders. Citing the German business newspaper Handelsblatt, she said that the art market wasn't being put in the dock, but she adds, the dealer has to know to whom he is selling. Social damage. Art dealers cite, moreover, contemporary studies that they say show how little the German art market has to do with financing terrorism, as has been claimed since September 11, 2001. Peter Rauer also makes reference to such a study when arguing against the new regulations. The ILICID study, published in July of this year, an independent project financed by the German Federal Ministry assigned to investigate the illegal trade in cultural goods in Germany, determined that the assertion often made by UNESCO that there was a worldwide illegal trade in works of art of around $6 billion did not withstand scrutiny. This study estimates the scope of the legal art market in ancient cultural goods in Germany at just 800,000 euros per year. Concerning illegal art dealing, let alone financing terror, there are no findings at all. But that's not really the problem. In financing terror, the art trade plays at most a subordinate role. Compare Chapter 3. The new law, which the industry opposes, is principally focused on the commonplace money laundering and tax evasion that are committed daily, not by terrorists, but by upright citizens cloaked in ostensible legality. The tangible damage caused by this antisocial behavior, the political and social harm that these perpetrators can wreak, is considerably higher than collectors are willing to admit. International experts argue for the elimination of special rules, like handshake deals and cash transactions. and the end to the strange insistence upon business secrecy, which the art trade justifies based on long-standing tradition and the special cultural significance of art. Just how long this absurd argument has abetted criminal activities is demonstrated by the ongoing debate about the ownership of art stolen by the Nazis and the scandal concerning the forger Wolfgang Baltracchi, who invented the fictitious Jaeger collection, whose provenance allegedly could never become known. Once again, the problem was compounded when prominent art dealers used anonymous letterbox companies in offshore tax havens and were drawn into this business of selling what later turned out to be forged artworks. The witnesses presented during the trial in Cologne refused to provide information about who had bought specific artworks. Questionable practices were permitted in the name of independence and the art trade's requirement for secrecy, as the Brazilian money-laundering expert Fausto Martin de Sanctis described these customs that are defended as grounded in common law, but, in fact, have no juridical support. At the same time, legal proceedings, reports in the international press, and various studies suggest that international, organized, illegal crime syndicates could be behind it. Based on that finding, this legal expert concludes that there must be clear and systematic guidelines about money laundering with regard to art to exclude all criminality, closer attention to banking or non-banking transactions in order to prevent money laundering is not following to business in galleries or international auction houses, which have become centers for cultural diffusion and eminently social institutions. Professor Bussmann asks similarly that a maximum amount for cash transactions be introduced. It should be understood that a limit of 5,000 euros would exclude the bulk of consumer goods. In general, even the German market appears to be switching over to simplified non-cash payment methods, as shown recently in the intense competition for the use of cashless payment methods through smartphones. Although the market can mostly switch to cashless payments, the practice of accepting cash payments for lucrative deals in the 5 to 6 figure range continues nonetheless, as the trades in real estate, art, and luxury cars show. Lawmakers must eliminate the pathways to money laundering. In most countries, one would have to wait too long for the market itself to set an upper boundary. And the American lawyer Phoebe Kouvelas has developed a checklist of red flags with which all participants in the market can determine whether they are being drawn into a transaction involving an attempt to launder money. The price of the artworks lies significantly below or above the market value. The artwork is an antiquity, and or the country of origin has recently been the site of conflict. The artwork is presented with little or only very meager documentation. The buyer insists on paying large sums in cash. The buyer insists on paying for a single transaction with separate small payments. The client refuses to provide sufficient information about personal identity or ownership. Intermediaries act at the behest of unknown buyers or sellers. Buyers or sellers wish to route a payment through a third party. Not all of these red flags mean unequivocally that money laundering is being attempted, but as Phoebe Kouvelas explains, they indicate that further measures need to be taken in order to rule out such possibility. Freeports, the dark rooms of the global art business. Today, for really expensive art, the super-rich use a vault that doesn't even try to be inconspicuous. It's as big as a multi-story warehouse and shines in the night far and wide. The architects plan the building with delicate care. Green spotlights illuminate the facade of the massive building, which looks as if it were covered in cloth and lies in close proximity to the airport in Singapore. Visitors must pass through numerous locked gates and security barriers, and at the end, be x-rayed by an armed security guard. Then they enter a huge atrium marked by a spectacular sculpture by the designer Ron Arad. A kind of lattice of reflective metal winds its way for several meters upwards through the space. Arad has given it a telling title, Cage Without Borders. Through fireproof, multiple secured doors, One arrives at the storerooms and laboratories where artworks are examined, professionally photographed, and restored. There's also a framing workshop on site. Various air conditioning systems ensure that the temperature remains at 20 degrees Celsius and 55% relative humidity. Clients of the Freeport can rent so-called showrooms to present the art stored there to their business partners or to sell artworks. Business can be taken care of in small, elegantly furnished offices, discreetly and securely, as the internet page reads. If desired, the works stored at the Freeport can, as a special service, be exhibited in the museums in Singapore, free of tariffs, indirect taxes, or payment of a deposit. The back door leads directly onto the landing field of the airport. Items can be brought from airplanes without any detours directly into the building. Collectors can travel by limousine from their airplanes into what is under customs law the extraterritorial area of the Freeport. On a tour through the building, visitors are shown gigantic X-ray machines, which are used to examine large shipping containers for explosives and other prohibited substances. Forged pictures or falsified provenance are, of course, not detected by these apparatuses. For years, this enormous vault, which earlier went by the name Singapore Freeport and is called Le Freeport today, was advertised at the biggest art fairs in the world. It was supposed to provide protection not only from theft, natural calamities, and climate fluctuations, but also, and most especially, from the reach of tax authorities. There appears to be nothing that the rich fear more than the tax man. A favorite topic among collectors when they meet in the VIP lounges and the free limousine shuttles at art fairs such as Art Basel Hong Kong or Frieze in London is apparently the excessive demands of tax authorities. It's not accidental that many of the successful art fairs are held in places that offer templates for tax avoidance to the super rich. Freeports and tariff-free storerooms have played an increasingly important role since the start of the new millennium. They are the duty-free zones and dark rooms of the international art market. Legal business transactions may be conducted there, but also transactions involving money whose origin is unclear. One can hide objects with delicate provenance from the claims of the Nazis' victims, or conceal illegally excavated objects from governments. The Freeports developed in the boom years of the art market into the bunkers for beauty. They also house masterpieces with a clean history of ownership, securely packed away, of course, seen only by the surveillance cameras of the security guards. For art serves as an investment vehicle and is more favorable from a tax and actuarial perspective. The speculative value appears to have transcended the value of everyday enjoyment and the symbolic value that one usually gains by exhibiting an artwork. Freeports are thus an integral component of a system that deprives art of its most important purpose, to be seen. Not only do they serve as dark rooms in which anything is possible and everyone remains anonymous, they are also the black holes of the art universe. The history of Freeports. There have been freeports and warehouses for a long time in many trading centers and port cities of the world. They are extraterritorial under tax laws. Originally, the freeports were conceived as places for short-term storage of goods that were intended for further transport by import and export businesses, without import taxes or customs tariffs becoming immediately due in the given country. These levies were to be extracted when delivery was made to the customer at their final destination, not at a transfer point. But in the global art trade, this system, which was supposed to provide distributors with bureaucratically simple, tax-neutral interim storage, was exploited and perverted. In freeports in Switzerland, Luxembourg, and Singapore, works of art worth billions of dollars are warehoused not just for days or weeks, but for years and even decades, for a variety of purposes. For example, to artificially constrict the market for Picasso or Warhol, or to wait out the statute of limitations on legal action. And that's not all. The art can be sold tax-free, Often these transactions are conducted by letterbox companies that are registered in tax havens like Panama or the British Virgin Islands, thus concealing the true owners. Some of the most well-known freeports are located traditionally in Switzerland, at the Zurich-Kloten Airport, in the Dreispitz quarter of Basel, or in Geneva's La Praye. According to Swiss estimates for 2013, in the Geneva Freeport alone, 1.2 million works of art were stored, in addition to 3 million bottles of wine. The Freeport is the biggest wine cellar in the world, the director has stated. Large insurance companies point to the quick increase in coverage amounts that the construction of the new freeports has necessitated. Antiquities from illegal excavations and art stolen by Nazis in the Geneva duty-free warehouse. Until 2007, the Swiss freeport warehouses weren't even monitored by customs. The Swiss Federal Audit Office wrote in a 2014 report that the duty-free warehouses had frequently proved to be gray zones with a high risk of smuggling and illegal activities. When the Swiss authorities instituted more exacting monitoring, stolen goods were found. Thus, in January 2016, two Etruscan sarcophagi were seized at the Geneva Freeport warehouse and returned to the Italian government. They had been stored in the warehouse for 15 years, along with vases and other objects. A British antiquities dealer had put them there. The investigations confirmed the suspicion that it was a case of illegal excavation. Another sarcophagus, with a dubious provenance, was seized at the same location in 2015 and returned to Turkish authorities. The Geneva duty-free warehouse made headlines in April 2016 when a work by Amadeo Modigliani, conservatively valued at $25 million, was seized there. The painting Homme Assis, circa 1918, had once belonged to the Jewish gallerist and collector Oskar Stettiner. He had to leave it behind when he fled from Paris in 1939. The Nazis in occupied Paris auctioned off the painting along with his other property. Decades later, ownership of the painting, Homme Assis, was transferred by way of a Christie's auction to an offshore company called International Art Center. There had long been speculation about who was behind this company. Certainty arrived in 2016 with the publication of the so-called Panama Papers. Secret documentation of the establishment of offshore companies by the specialty law firm Mossack Fonseca. David Namad, scion of one of the most successful art-dealing families in the international trade, was closely allied with the International Art Center. The Namads have been dealing art for decades in London, New York, and Paris. At the big auctions at Christie's and Sotheby's, they can be seen time and again sitting in the front rows and bidding. Sometimes different members of the family appear to be bidding against each other. The Namads own not just dozens but hundreds of works by artists such as Picasso, Braque, and Miro. How many exactly and which ones are not publicly known. In October 2011, the public was afforded a rare peek at the quality of the collection, when about 100 selected works by Monet, Magritte, Gries, Kandinsky, and especially Picasso were shown in the Kunsthaus in Zurich. The exhibition was controversial because the difference between the collection and inventory for sale by the Namads was, at least from the outside, hardly clear. The museum was being misused to increase the value of goods for commerce, critics asserted. In an article about the exhibition in the newspaper Neue Zürcher Zeitung, the Namad's holdings at the Geneva Customs Warehouse were estimated at 5,000 works valued at many billions of Swiss francs, including 300 works by Picasso alone. Only Picasso's family is said to own more of his pictures. A lawsuit by a grandchild of Oskar Stettiner in a New York court for the return of the painting Homme Assis had not yet been decided at the time that work on this book ended. David Namad's lawyer argued that the Modigliani owned by International Art Center had nothing to do with Oskar Stettiner's painting. In holding that the complaint contained a sufficient factual basis to state a claim, the New York judge opined in April 2018, New York is not and shall not become a safe harbor for art pillaged during Nazi genocide. The King of Freeports, Yves Bouvier. The man who first made the system of freeports truly productive for art dealers is one of the most interesting shadow figures in the international art trade. Yves Bouvier, born in Switzerland in 1963, was one of the main lessees of the Geneva duty-free warehouse. He built the freeport in Singapore, described earlier, and later he established yet another facility in Luxembourg, thus earning him the moniker the Freeport King. This success story took a shocking turn in February 2015, when Bouvier was arrested in Monaco on his way to visit one of his best clients. Bouvier started his career in the family business, the shipping company Naturel Le Coutre, domiciled in Geneva. In 1997, he took over management of the business from his father, and in subsequent years developed it into one of the most important logistics operations in the art world. Objects were no longer simply transported, they were securely warehoused, restored, and photographed. Freeports aren't some kind of smuggler's den, Bouvier averred in a 2013 conversation with J. Emil Sennewald for the German weekly newspaper Die Zeit. Only idiots still try to hide drugs in artworks or to conceal stolen goods. Such a thing would be discovered because everything that goes in or out is precisely registered and X-rayed. We help unmask art thefts. In the register of Swiss companies, Bouvier's name appeared, apart from the family firm, in connection with a dozen other entities that were also involved in the art business. Intermittently, through one of these companies, he organized art fairs in Moscow and Salzburg, and he owned numerous residences in various countries. Of course, his expansion plans extended further. Freeports were to be established in Shanghai and Beijing, and near Paris there were plans for an entire art island. Bouvier planned an art center for 28,000 square meters of land on the Île Seguin, where earlier the billionaire François Pinault had wanted to display his art collection, before turning his attention to Venice and central Paris. Jean Nouvel was to design the architecture for Bouvier's so-called hub, with plenty of room for studios, apartments for a residency, exhibition spaces, storerooms, and auction halls. The cost of the project, which was named R4, was estimated to be 100 million euros. It will become an art Disneyland in which one can experience everything that is happening in art, Bouvier said in 2013. 3 years later, as Bouvier was embroiled in several legal proceedings, the land for the project was sold to the collector Laurent Dumas, who soon introduced new architects and new plans for the site.